is into the frustrating infinite regress where everything has to be explained and endlessly. This is the state, or lack thereof, portrayed in the multiplication of languages that emerges in parallel with the collapse of the Tower of Babel. Our words make sense only insofar as they refer to experiences that are self-evident in the absence of words, experiences that are grounded in the realms of matter, behavior, and imagination. When you are arguing with someone and you say, "I am angry with you," they typically ask, "Why are you angry?" and not, "What do you mean, angry?" The interlocutor already knows what angry means, and not just semantically, not just as a word embedded in a web of words, but also at an embodied emotional, motivational, and experiential level. We do not have to ask another human being what it means to be angry, and can even understand anger when manifested by a non-human animal, because we have been angry ourselves, because we share a biological platform with the person we are communicating with, can experience for ourselves the state of anger, can infer and assume a non-semantic similarity of rage-like experience. That shared embodiment, and not the abstract understanding, provides the foundation allowing for communication itself. This does not mean that everything human is translatable to the animal, or vice versa. If a lion could speak, we could not understand him, so the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein claimed in Paraphrased Essence. It is more accurately stated, if a lion could speak, we would still struggle to understand his point. This is partly because to understand actually means to translate from the semantic to the imaginative and then to the embodied, to change the way we perceive, conceptualize, and act as a consequence of communicating. This indicates profoundly that full understanding requires shared embodiment, similar emotion, motivation, and possibility for perception and action. Otherwise, there would be no limit to the necessity of translation. We need a shared rock of certainty under our feet so that we can all stand upon it while we talk. This is the center that necessarily anchors even the marginal and that gives even the latter its possibility of existence, subdued place, and purpose. Prideful rejection of that underlying commonality makes all communication impossible. This is obvious once the preconditions for understanding itself are properly understood. Some basics have to be assumed as axiomatic before inquiry into other ideas can even begin. Something, at least, has to be taken as a given. Something has to serve as a maypole of orientation, a flag in the ground around which everything else can unquestioningly rotate. That is the one miracle that creation has to be granted even to exist. That is the reason not only for the necessity of faith, but for its veritable inevitability. The question of faith itself is thus best conceptualized not as, is faith necessary, but in what form is the faith that is necessary best realized? Without that shared center, the domain of disagreement rapidly becomes so large that either chaos itself reigns or conflict becomes inevitable. It is difficult enough to disagree civilly about one thing at a time. When everything is up in the air, there's nothing that can be jointly referred to, even as a starting point for negotiation or potentially shared mutual aim. The pathway to peace is therefore always initiated by something approximating, what, if anything, do we agree upon, hold constant, regard as sacred, consider mutually indisputable, even in the midst of our disagreement? Can we therefore expand the domain of shared territory that we already jointly inhabit? Married people, when arguing, better at least agree that the marriage should continue and that the love that they at least once had could, however hypothetically, make itself known again, or at least that such rebirth and regeneration of continued and desirable relationship should be the aim. It is also the case that the flagpole, staff of tradition, or rod of patriarchal certainty had better be planted in the right place, or the ground so demarcated cannot be inhabited and the game cannot be played. The common narrative trope of the magician, wizard, or even god slamming his magic wand or hammer down into the ground with waves of invisible power that radiate outward from it reflects or indicates something like such a truth. What does all this mean in the context of the Tower of Babel story? If the technological enterprise aims itself at something deviating too far from the necessary psychological and social ideal, the central uniting axis, even the possibility of communication vanishes. Then we become confounded in our language. We find ourselves presently at war over the most basic of issues, that of sex. What is driving our confusion? It is certainly possible that the basic conceptual or even perceptual axiom, the most basic category of reality itself, whatever reality might be, and it is certainly more than the merely objective world, is male and female, as intimated in Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. Failure to differentiate on the basis of sex means failure to propagate. And failure to propagate means more than mere death. It means true extinction. Thus, the ability to differentiate man from woman is equivalent to the ability and willingness to circumvent non-being itself. Perhaps there might be an ability to categorize that is more fundamental, the capacity to distinguish edible from inedible, up from down, day from night, or even life from death. Nonetheless, the sexual distinction is so basic that life itself ceases in its absence. How could the same demise not await mere communication when the most basic of definitions is blurred? Sexual differentiation itself occurred somewhere between 1.2 and 1.5 billion years ago. Nervous systems did not develop until something approximating a billion years later. This means that sexual differentiation was a brute fact of life for 1,000 million years before even the rudiments of conscious perception were possible. It is for this reason, among many others, that sexual differentiation itself is employed with utter universality as a metaphor for the binary relationship between many other phenomena, or even between the most basic classes of phenomena themselves. So, for example, the Taoists divide the world of experience into yin and yang and presume that reality as such is comprised of the eternal interplay between these two permanent categories, each of which is associated with the sex. Yin is the feminine, associated with chaos, night, darkness, possibility, and change. Yang is the masculine, associated with order, day, light, actuality, and permanence. Why are we questioning that axiom now? How is that confusion, associated with the pride, resentment, corruption, worship of the technological, and hedonism of the Tower of Babel? Because we have decided to usurp the right to absolute self-definition, instead of leaving that as an element of the transcendent or the axiomatic, as an element of the faith that is necessary and inevitable. The person who insists on the unquestionable primacy of self-definition is, after all, stating, "I am that I am," or "I am who I am," attempting thereby to elevate the self to the level of ultimate axiom, precisely as the God of the Old Testament does when he speaks to Moses of his being. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thou shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. Exodus 3:14. This means a denial not only of the transcendent on the spiritual side, but also on the material, biological, and the social side. It is not for naught that the Narcissus who fell in love with his own reflection drowned in consequence. And nothing more narcissistic than the absolute claim to self-identity can be posited or even imagined. And precisely what self is being thereby identified? It is far from obvious what the self actually constitutes in the final analysis. The whim of the moment, particularly on the solely sexual front, seems like a poor candidate for elevation to that exalted and central position. Such subjugation to the grip and immediacy of instinct is nothing but the impulse of a toddler or, in the case of an adult, of a very immature and counterproductively self-centered man or woman indeed. And why, therefore, is the self being announced as the master of the domain of so-called subjective identification axiomatically assumed to be identical to the latest whim celebrated in the popular culture? It is a perilously short distance from I am whatever I desire sexually to I have the right to whatever I want now in relationship to any short-term consumatory desire. Thus, I can demand that all my economic needs be met by others. I can insist that no ideas that cause me anxiety ever arise. And I can reject all standards of beauty, merit, or value whose existence might cause me to question my transcendent value and absolute right to immediate gratification. There is simply no compelling a priori reason other than a staggeringly narcissistic desire for everything I want here and now and to hell with everything and everyone else, to identify the totality of the self with any element of that ever-shifting array of desires. And yet, we are increasingly compelled to act, speak, and believe as if there is. That compulsion is identical to the worship of confusion, disunity, and the idiot immediacy of the moment. This, of course, means that the so-called true or genuine self, that unquestionable voice of lived experience, is not only to take precedence over the needs and wants of other people, but over the medium to long-term stability, hope, and productive function of the individual in question. However, that self is little or even nothing more than the desire that currently dominates. The gratification of its desire is equivalent to the sacrifice of the other to the self, and the future, even of the person concerned, to the present, to say nothing of the other to the self. A lower and more counterproductive form of self-definition can hardly be imagined. No community whatsoever, and certainly no civilization, can be founded on that endlessly shifting sand. Obviously, that is why we do not see united tribes of two-year-olds striking out successfully on their own. This insistence on the primacy of subjective self-definition is therefore not only the subjugation of everyone and everything to the tyrannical demands of the present, a move providing no basis whatsoever for a stable, productive society, but the elimination of anything approximating a higher order self capable of acting in relationship to the broader social context and the future. This is most evident, perhaps, in the well-documented tendency of those characterized by dark tetrad personality traits, narcissism, Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and sadism, to prefer so-called short-term mating strategies, that is, pursuit of personal sexual pleasure in the absence of any commitment practical or emotional. And that means without any relationship of any genuine kind. The narcissists have an enhanced sense of self-importance, a desire for admiration, and a lack of empathy for others, expressed in their refusal to reciprocate. They pursue short-term sexual encounters as a means to gain validation, boost their comparative social standing, their ego, and fulfill their narrow desires. The Machiavellians, manipulative, exploitative, and skilled in strategic social maneuvering, deploy deceptive tactics to achieve their goals, including those involving sexual satisfaction. They use others for personal gain, engaging in casual sexual encounters or outright infidelity without emotional attachment. The psychopaths are characterized by an absence of empathy and remorse, contempt for social norms, a comprehensive impulsivity, inability to delay gratification, precisely that attitude of I want what I want right now and to hell with you in the future, and limited or no capacity to learn from experience. They are as well, unsurprisingly, since they don't care even for themselves, entirely exploitative on the sexual front, willing to dispense with such niceties as true consent, employing emotional manipulation, and turning to more coercive tactics if mere manipulation fails. Sadistic individuals, finally, derive positive delight from humiliating and inflicting pain and suffering on others. Short-term mating strategies enable them to exert control, dominance, or power over their sexual partners. This proclivity appears to be part of a broader pattern of valuation. Short-term mating preference exists with the wish for power and the willingness or even eagerness to use it, and a marked and conspicuous consumerism and associated materialism, shades of the orgiastic celebration of the golden calf. The claim that the immediate demand of the short-term self takes priority over all other considerations, social and future, is the consequence of a stunningly counterproductive and personally and socially dangerous immaturity. Bad as that is, it is not all. Accompanying that immaturity is an associated rejection of the burden and responsibility of genuine adventure in life, and the resultant attraction of false and hypothetically easy to attain variants of meaning, worth, excitement, and identity. This is the pleasure island that the delinquent Lampwick, a name that clearly refers to Lucifer, entices Disney's Pinocchio to visit after the false physicians convince the puppet that he is a sick victim in need of holiday, relaxation, and amusement, as well as the Neverland that Peter Pan chooses as his domain to inhabit and rule, with its accompanying imaginary female companion, Tinkerbell, the porn fairy. Such false adventure might and often does include the immediate pleasures of drug and alcohol misuse, practices also integrally associated with both dark tetrad and antisocial personality attributes, as well as acceptance and promotion of the moralizing and self-serving justifications of a purposefully thoughtless resentment and, if convenient, its associated ideology. Why else might we currently find ourselves confused, Luciferian, and prone to erecting endless towers of Babel? Perhaps because our very selves have become disoriented by the extension of our identity into the virtual world. We can be whomever we want to be in our online forms, or so we think. The more time we spend there, the more uncertain we become of who we are. The more time we can also break free, in some ways, many of which are ultimately destructive, of the limitations that bind us in the non-virtual, real world. The lines between fiction, fantasy, and fact blur in the online world. And purposefully so, it is a place suited to experimentation. But it is absolutely one thing to toy with alternate selves so that a more effective mode of being or becoming can be realized, and another to maintain immaturity or adopt a delusional self for the purposes of immediate gratification and avoidance of responsibility. Abstraction allows for the thought that can die instead of us. It also gives rise to the possibility of possession by delusion when what is improper grows cancer-like instead of being pruned by judgment. This is another danger of the prideful and unwise presumption of the technologists. Perhaps it is also because we have interfered with the pretend play that children must engage in to establish their adult identities, sexual and otherwise, replacing it with time spent engaged with screens. Perhaps it is because we have become enticed to dream all too imprudently, even transhumanly, of escape from the limitations of this mortal coil, lacking proper gratitude for the opportunities, challenges, and adventures that those very limitations provide. Perhaps it is finally because we have abandoned the respect for tradition, ancestry, and the paternal/maternal authority on which the desire to mature, as well as maturation itself, necessarily depends. This is a complex whose upshot is that we continually violate another fundamental commandment, the very one on which optimized childhood experience and parenting, as well as dignified aging, intergenerational cooperation itself, in a phrase, depends. Honor thy father and thy mother, Exodus 20:12. Without such honor, all the necessary constraints of tradition vanish. Worse, if possible, the future itself degenerates as absence of respect for father and mother simultaneously means absence of respect for the future self. We gaze without a commensurate shame on the nakedness of our parents. How can that be anything but indicative of inevitable degeneration? Why not face that eventuality with nothing but anxiety and a nihilistic and destructive outlook? All of those attitudes are variants of the spirit that built the Tower of Babel, a tower we currently inhabit and are building ever higher, while we simultaneously abandon the principles on which civility, peace, and generous productivity depend. In consequence, our psychological integrity degenerates in tandem with our capacity to communicate with one another in peace or even at all. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime they had for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Genesis 11, 1-10. Men determined to raise their works upward toward an ideal, to make us a name, to establish a prideful notoriety and status, and to unite under that falsehood, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth, that is, be divided and disunited. There is a truly admirable aspect of all that, aim, ambition, and community, but not when narrowly self-serving, not when serving self or local potentate. Understanding this also clarifies what happens next, an occurrence or happening that could otherwise be attributed to an apparent jealousy on the part of God. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Is it that God is objecting to anything that might encroach on his territory, revealing a reprehensible envy on his part? Or is it instead that the human imagination is such that no form of hell is too low to be created by those with sufficient pretension, and that God rightfully objects to that eventuality and providentially attempts to interfere? The National Socialists were, after all, both imaginative and capable, even though they stretched their tower to the morning star and not to God himself. Would a good God then not precisely be the force that sowed confusion and discord in the midst of a false unity? Is this then not divine envy, but rather the attempt to foil the Luciferian spirit? Is this then not another revealed aspect of the unified good? By definition, that is the insistence of the author of the story of the Tower of Babel. 5.4, God or else. In the opening verses of Genesis, God is portrayed as the spirit oriented by love and truth, who eternally generates from the primordial chaos of potential, the habitable order that is good. That same spirit is soon said to govern the relationship between the opposites, darkness and light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. Genesis 1:4-5. That is the spirit characterizing men and women alike in their deepest essence and providing to human beings the consequential responsibility and opportunity of earthly governance. Genesis 1:26-27. This creative, transcendent, unifying spirit is also deemed to be radically pro-life and pro-child in its orientation, as in Genesis 1:28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. It sets before men and women the initial paradise of being with all its manifest possibilities. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. Genesis 1:30-31. The unifying spirit insists that this divine characterization of men and women and provision of commensurate responsibility and opportunity is maximally desirable and morally appropriate. Hence, the very, which is only applied to the doings of the sixth day, which closes with this proclamation. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Genesis 1:31. It also establishes the limits on action and presumptions, or axiomatic preconditions, that make paradisal being possible. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Genesis 2:15-17. It is the same transcendent, unified, monotheistic spirit that assigns to Adam the as of yet incomplete, because unpaired with woman, ability and obligation to categorize and order the world. the crucial and responsible aspect of subdue. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet for him." And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all cattle and to the fowl of the air and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found an helpmeet for him. Genesis 2, 18 to 20. That spirit also divides the original, symbolically hermaphroditic man into the paired and contentious opposition that is nonetheless called on to become a harmonious unity. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib, which the Lord God had taken from man, made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Genesis 2, 21 to 25. More aspects of the same superordinate or heavenly spirit make themselves known as the next stories unfold. Well, the fundamental importance of certain aspects already revealed is reiterated, stressed, and characterized more thoroughly. This is all part of the process by which all that is good comes to be integrated. This means conflicts between moral duties can be minimized and everything is put in its proper place in relationship to one another. It is the process by which the sum of all good comes to be defined and understood. Genesis 2, 15 to 17, for example, establishes the injunction against presuming for oneself the right to question or establish the most basic of moral truths. That most basic truth is something like the axiomatic definition of good and evil itself, or even the proclamation or assumption that such a distinction exists, which is in turn a fundamental and defining presumption about the nature of reality itself. Genesis 3, the account of the serpent of the garden, is a deep exploration of that theme, which has as its conclusion, however implicit, that the fundamental enemy of stable, harmonious being and productive becoming is precisely that which tempts us to presume this right by appealing to the most prideful desire of all, the wish to replace or become God himself. Cataclysmic consequences ensue, as we have seen. The moral of the story, once again, do not ascribe to yourself the right to question the minimal necessary preconditions for harmonious being established by what is truly transcendent, or all is lost. Certain axioms must be held as sacred for the game itself to proceed without degenerating into a fallen, self-conscious, prideful hell. Hence our eternal enmity with the serpent, our conception in sorrow, the involuntary subjugation of woman to man, the cursed conditions of fallen toil, the expulsion from paradise, and the barring of the pathway forward to heaven. Alternatively, perhaps, do not arrogate to yourself the right to become God without engaging in the proper sacrifices. Precisely those that, because they are aimed at the highest possible pinnacle, must be of the most complete, comprehensive, and dramatic nature. Such offerings are, even by logical necessity, those associated with the ultimately difficult process, say, of accepting responsibility for the sins of the world and paying the price for exactly that. What is that price? To become God in the absence of pride, or perhaps more subtly but accurately, one with God, is to give up everything that is not God. Happiness, security, wealth, love, friendship, national identity, as none of those are or should be, God. This, of course, requires nothing less than the sacrifice that is ultimate. And what presumptuous questions exactly should not be asked, or what voices not listened to, what places should not be regarded as acceptable to dwell, what, if anything, or who, is off limits? Is there any difference between such questions and the idea that there is some counsel that should not be followed, or some outsiders who cannot be brought into the fold, or some identities that cannot be adopted, or some foods that, because of their sheer and irremediable poisonousness, cannot be eaten? Are there no truly deadly and therefore properly forbidden ideas? Is all of this not the same as asking whether anything is truly evil, and therefore anything that is good, and therefore whether there is any distinction between good and evil? Was what transpired in Auschwitz, for example, in Nazi Germany, wrong or not? Were the actions of those who ran Unit 731 in China under Japanese occupation merely following orders, merely and righteously adhering to their own time and situation-specific relativistic ethic? Is there any real difference between man and woman, up and down, Abel and Cain, or Christ and Satan? There is a price to be paid, no matter the answer. If morality is relative, then Auschwitz was not evil, but only unfortunate, and the latter only from the far from universal perspective of the victims. For the absolute sadists of Unit 731, likewise, the victims were merely the justifiable means to the most desirable of purely narcissistic ends. Who is to say, and why, that the Nazi or Japanese self-definition of appropriate purpose was wrong, particularly when done in the name of and even published under the guise of scientific experimentation? If morality is relative, then medical experiments of unimaginable horror, from the arbitrary perspective of the modern viewer, can be conducted without hesitation on those powerless enough to be made subject to them. If morality is relative, then no true distinction can be drawn between Stalin and Churchill, between Mao and Lincoln, between the mass murderer and sadist Karl Panzram and the rescuing hero Oscar Schindler, between Simon Legree from Uncle Tom's Cabin and Alyosha Karamazov from The Brothers Karamazov. And if no true distinction can be drawn between the rationalists of the French Revolution and the subjective delights of the Marquis de Sade, if no true, that is, transcendently and eternally true, judgment of relative worth is possible, even in principle, why follow the difficult, straight, and narrow path that leads up, rather than the wide, easy, and immediately, even intensely pleasurable, road down? It should be noted in this regard, not least for the sake of a sufficiently thorough investigation, that it is not only a rational skepticism, which can be admirable in certain situations, that drives the relativistic endeavor. Everything has its shadow side. Just as religious belief in its naive forms can, in fact, serve those in power as the opiate of the masses, can provide, as per the Freudian view, an immature and unsophisticated defense against death anxiety, can more generally serve and maintain and justify a childish dependency, so too can the skepticism of an enlightened moral relativism enable, camouflage, and even justified delight in the rejection of all responsibility. And far worse. This is particularly true when the skeptic is simultaneously insisting that, in the final analysis, nothing really matters. This is the all-too-convenient shrugging off of all moral obligation, the rejection of all transcendent existential burden, the elimination of everything of crucial import, and the maintenance of an increasingly toxic immaturity and self-centeredness. That is the wish for the complete absence of any obligation whatsoever. This also means, in a manner darker still, the presumption at least of equality, with hints of an underlying skeptical superiority to anything great, past or present, as nothing can be deemed truly great in the absence of a non-relative ethic. So there is no qualitative distinction between the childish dauber of mud on a canvas and the work of Rembrandt. A conclusion of great and unearned benefit to the former, if a little rough on the latter. And even that roughness might well be desirable if the real game being played is vengeance by the usurper. If the cost of such overwhelming benefit to the prideful, impulsive, unreliable, and hedonistic is the absence of any deep purpose and meaning, so be it. Or so the devil who waits eternally at the crossroads of choice forever insists. But if we accept the proposition that there is no real down, no real hell, no real and final moral transgression, then we must also accept the proposition that there is no real up, no real heaven, no real goal, and no hope. And in that acceptance itself, there is no shortage of confusion, disorientation, abandonment in the desert, faithlessness, and despair. The affects that fill life with enthusiasm, curiosity, excitement, engagement, entertainment, and interest only make themselves manifest in relationship to a goal. No goal? No hope. And worse, life does not merely become meaningless in the absence of such positive emotion, because meaning is not merely positive. Life is also suffering, and suffering is a form of meaning. Thus, in the place where there is no up, down remains unchanged in its existential reality, being something far more than mere conception, and therefore something much more inescapable, regardless of reigning delusion. Suffering continues unabated in the realm of the nihilist, continues unameliorated by mere skepticism. And that means that an untrammeled relativism, the insistence that all things are open for question, destroys both faith and hope, but leaves terror and pain absolutely untouched. There is little difference between that horrible leaving and the most precipitous fall into the deepest abyss. What is life without hope but hell? And that is the end result of moral relativism, not some neutral rationality. But if we reject the blandishments of a careless relativism, what do we celebrate, worship, and leave unquestioned? What is it that is truly sacred? What is the Ark of the Covenant itself? What is touched, even accidentally, at the greatest of peril? Again, David gathered together all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people that were with him from Baal of Judah to bring up from thence the Ark of God, whose name is called by the name of the Lord of hosts that dwelleth between the cherubims. And they set the Ark of God upon a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab that was in Gibeah. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drave the new cart. And they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was at Gibeah, accompanying the Ark of God. And Ahio went before the Ark. David and all the house of Israel played before the Lord on all manner of instruments made of fir wood, even on harps and on psalteries and on timbrels and on cornets and on cymbals. And when they came to Nashon's threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen shook it. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error, and there he died by the ark of God. 2 Samuel 1-8. What, to say it another way, a variety of other ways, is the unshakable vow, the immovable object, the unquestionable axiom, the inviolable covenant, the rock of ages, the cornerstone, albeit rejected by the builder? Luke 20:17, Matthew 21:42, Mark 12:10. It is the establishment in the highest place, or at the ultimate foundation of being and becoming, of the spirit variously characterized in the stories of the biblical corpus. It is the determination to imitate or incarnate that spirit. It is the God with whom we are eternally wrestling, by definition. As Genesis 3 continues, God is revealed as he who walks with men and women in the absence of prideful and painful self-consciousness. 3:8-13. He who attends to and punishes presumptuous and imprudent deviations from the straight and narrow path. 3:16-24. In the story of Cain and Abel, God is as well the highest good to which sacrifice must be devoted. Genesis 4:3-4. And the spirit who admonishes when the best is not forthcoming. Genesis 4:4-7. In the account of the flood, God is the spirit who calls the wise to prepare when the storms are brewing. Genesis 6:13-18. In the story of the Tower of Babel, God is characterized as the spirit that must be ensconced at the very top, lest everything catastrophically disintegrate, even the capacity to utter and abide by the redeeming word. Genesis 11:7-19. Those who doubt the veracity of such stories might ask themselves, what does history teach us? What happens in the real world when we emulate the wrong model, when we worship a false god, when we undermine the foundation or place the wrong spirit at the top? What happens more specifically to the towers of Babel that we constantly create and recreate when they become top-heavy and arrogant, when they take to themselves the attributes of omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence? Is that not the very definition of the totalitarian state? The leaders of such societies elevate themselves, or what they purport to believe, generally something that supports their claim to the moral necessity of elevating themselves to the top. Was that proclivity not precisely characteristic of the worst monsters of the 20th century, of Stalin, Hitler, and Mao? And what was the consequence? Complete misunderstanding, complete inability to communicate, absolute absence of the ability to engage in productive dialogue, not least because the principle of the logos itself, on which dialogos obviously depends, had not only been abandoned, but inverted, not least because every inhabitant of such a state lied about absolutely everything to themselves and everyone else all the time, not least because participation in that endless litany of lies meant that what was most self-evidently true had to be continually denied. One of the most frightening themes in the terrifying account of Soviet tyranny put forth by Alexander Solzhenitsyn was precisely that. If a Soviet citizen in the time of Stalin dared complain, even of his own pain, he was immediately and irrevocably deemed an enemy of the state and made liable to brutal punishment, along with his family and perhaps all those who knew and supported him. You know You are truly in hell when you cannot even admit to the reality of your own suffering. There is nihilism and moral relativism taken to their final extremes. Even your terror and pain, and worse, that of those you love, must be denied. Does this mean that no one who is truly in hell admits to the existence of the very place in which they dwell? Such is very likely to be the case, and more the horror. Here is Solzhenitsyn once again, post-prison, meditating on his youthful pride and arrogance. In the intoxication of youthful successes, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was therefore cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments. And it was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. And the same author, somewhat later, commenting on the willingness of prideful ideologues to lie even about their own misery while refusing to accept the evidence of the suffering of others. My friend Panin and I are lying on the middle shelf of a Stolypin compartment and have set ourselves up comfortably, tucked our salt herring in our pockets so we don't need water and can go to sleep. But at some station or other, they shove into our compartment a Marxist scholar. We can even tell this from his goatee and spectacles. He doesn't hide the fact he's a former professor of the Communist Academy. We hang head down in the square cutout, and from his first words, we see that he is impenetrable. But we have been serving time for a long while and have a long time left to serve, and we value a merry joke. We must climb down to have a bit of fun. There is ample space left in the compartment, and so we exchange places with someone and crowd in. Hello. Hello. You're not too crowded? No, it's all right. Have you been in the jug a long time? Long enough. Are you past the halfway mark? Just. Look over there, how poverty-stricken our villages are. Straw, thatch, crooked huts. An inheritance from the Tsarist regime. Well, but we've already had 30 Soviet years. That's an insignificant period historically. It's terrible that the collective farmers are starving. But have you looked in all their ovens? Just ask any collective farmer in our compartment. Everyone in jail is embittered and prejudiced. But I've seen collective farms myself. That means they were uncharacteristic. The goatee had never been in any of them. That way it was simpler. Just ask the old folks. Under the Tsar, they were well-fed, well-clothed, and they used to have so many holidays. I'm not even going to ask. It's a subjective trait of human memory to praise everything in the past. The cow that died is the one that gave twice the milk. Sometimes he even cited Proverbs. And our people don't like holidays. They like to work. But why is there a shortage of bread in many cities? When? Right before the war, for example. Not true. Before the war, in fact, everything had been worked out. Listen, at that time, in all the cities on the Volga, there were queues of thousands of people. Some local failure in supply, but more likely your memory is failing you. But there's a shortage now. Old wives' tales. We have from 7 to 8 billion poods of grain. And the grain itself is rotten. Not at all. We have been successful in developing new varieties of grain. And so forth. He is imperturbable. He speaks in a language which requires no effort of the mind. And arguing with him is like walking through a desert. It's about people like that that they say, he made the rounds of all the smithies and came home unshod. Why are Cain's descendants tempted to worship technological mastery? Not least because they're marked and excluded from the presence of God. In his absence, something else inevitably attempts to manifest itself as a unity, else the terrors of an excessive plurality or legion make themselves known. Thus, something else attempting to dominate will both lurk and tempt. Cain has already set himself up as the absolute judge of being, as evidenced by the temerity he manifests when he calls out God for the shortcomings of creation and simultaneously assumes, however implicitly, that he could do better. This is the heart of his resentment, leading to his welcoming the dominion of the spirit of pride or arrogance. Hence, the pathway from Cain through his descendants to the Tower of Babel, and their unstoppable proclivity toward an admiration for the spirit that totalizes. There is no difference between that progression and tendency and worship of the Luciferian intellect. The temptation to turn to purely technological solutions to eternal existential problems is in itself eternal, and the workings of men, intellectual and mechanical, do in fact have their pronounced and necessary place, at least when properly subdued. They nonetheless present a double-edged sword, as much danger in potential as benefit. Bigger cities and more material abundance also mean heavier weaponry and a more luxurious and increasingly dangerous complacence and arrogance. This is particularly true in the absence of a true covenant or ethic, which is the fundamental driver and source of peace, abundance, and opportunity. Here is something to consider when tempted to possession by the spirit that enticed and seduced Cain. If you do not perish in the flood, you may still die in the ruins of the Tower of Babel. The evil and prideful eternally drown in a plethora of chaos, or find themselves crushed by the forces of tyranny. Chapter 6. Abraham, God as Spirited Call to Adventure. 6.1. Go Forth. By the time we encounter Abraham, first Abram, we have met God in various ways. All those ways are, as we have intimated, the multiple and diverse characterizations of a unitary transcendent spirit. God is, variously, the creator of the order that is good from the chaos of possibility, the spirit of unself-conscious existence in the heavenly garden, the proper target of sacrifice, the voice compelling the wise to prepare in the face of the storm, and the foe of prideful and presumptuous tyrants. Genesis 12 shifts the focus. God supreme now makes himself known as the voice of inspired adventure. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will shew thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Genesis 12, 1-3. Much is condensed into these few lines. First is the idea that the divine unity also includes the voice that calls even the comfortable, infantile, and unwilling to the task and challenge of their life. This is the same spirit that impels the toddler to become the child, the adolescent, and the adolescent, the self-determining adult. This is the same spirit making itself present in the soul of the son or daughter who is granted ever more responsibility and opportunity with each voluntary step toward maturity. Second, in these brief verses, is an overwhelmingly optimistic promise. God tells those who hearken toward true adventure in the service of what is highest that their pursuit will fulfill not only the deepest longing of the forward-moving soul, but also constitute the most effective possible strategy for success. That success takes many forms. The opportunity to found something of lasting worth, Abraham's dynastic or national line, to do so in a manner that is profoundly meaningful and satisfying at the personal level, the promised blessing to self, and to earn simultaneously a stellar and well-deserved reputation, valid greatness of name. The covenant offers more yet. Abraham will establish his dynasty, serve as a blessing to himself, and make his name while doing so as a source of inspiration, encouragement, and genuine provision to others. Thou shalt be a blessing. Further, those who ally themselves with his adventurous endeavor will also succeed, while those who oppose it will fail. It is difficult indeed to imagine a better offer. But what does it mean about the expanding characterization of the divine? That the source of the impetus to develop personally is to be regarded as identical to the monotheistic Hebrew God, and that the manifestation of that divine spirit is what inspires us to admire and imitate true and genuine success. It is the spirit that establishes the legacy that endures, the same spirit that brings true benefit simultaneously to self and community, and which will be most resilient in the face of enmity. This is the divine inspiration that realizes itself in the calling to wrestle with self, world, nature, and God. What could be more wonderful than the existence of a true harmony between the instinct to integrate, share, master, and mature, and the operation of the process that establishes productive, generous, stable, and sheltering social order? This is the spirit that is simultaneously God, as the encouraging voice that calls to Abraham, and what Abraham could be and later is, the father to nations. What does this mean? It means that the essence of fatherhood itself, whether conceived of as something divine or human, is precisely the encouraging voice that rewards the impulse or possibly instinct within a child, adolescent, and even adult to take on challenge voluntarily, to develop further, to mature, to extend the self upward and grow toward the light, to handle serpents and to confront dragons rather than to seek security, hedonic self-gratification, or power. Thus, the word of God in the story of Abraham is deemed identical with the innate proclivity, although not the deterministic necessity, of a baby to take his or her first steps, to extend the hand of friendship and play courageously and hospitably with strangers in a playground, to reject the false friendship of those who will take their ball and go home if they do not get their way in the schoolyard, to stand up against the bullies of the hallway and the alley in favor of those who are younger or weaker and more vulnerable, and to desire and risk establishing a relationship with a member of the opposite sex and become reliable, loving husbands and wives and truly adult fathers and mothers themselves. This is what every true father is most deeply gratified to see when it realizes itself in the thoughts and deeds of his children, what most profoundly satisfies the man who has taken it on himself to care for his family. This speaks of the ultimate unity of father, child, and developmental trajectory, both forward and up. Is this an instinct? The instinct of striving child and attentive father alike? Or the voice or call of the divine? If there is an ultimate unity behind all things and toward which all life strives, there can be no true difference between the two. There is possibly nothing more optimistic than the idea that the path indicated by the spirit of adventure in childhood and adulthood alike is the same path whose walking is most pleasing to and simultaneously encouraged by the good father. That is something particularly true in conjunction with the accompanying and parallel claim that constitutes the soul of the covenant offered to Abram by God. The insistence and assurance that walking that very path will mean life becomes a subjective blessing in a manner that simultaneously ensures well-deserved social prestige and authority, establishes something of permanent value, even a worldwide dynasty, and that does all that in a form that brings nothing but benefit to everyone else at the same time. And who would dare put forth the contrary claim of disbelief in such an offering, which would necessarily be that the very impulse moving us forward toward true maturity and responsibility in our lives somehow makes itself manifest in opposition to personal thriving, communal respectability, profound accomplishment, and the well-being of others. This would mean that the very essence of our striving for life exists in a manner antithetical to our own good, or even the good itself, whether conceived of in the realm of the individual, the social, or the future. It is much simpler to presume, much more in keeping with the use of Occam's razor, scientifically, even evolutionarily speaking, that our natural or implicit way of being and becoming is one that unites us with our environment, social and natural, in the most harmonious and productive manner possible, all things considered, and that such calling emerges within us as the deepest instinct of forward development, including the adult emergence of the spirit of encouraging fatherhood. We have already encountered God as the word of truth, aiming upward, that establishes and reestablishes the order that is good. That portrayal is part of the monotheistic insistence that the adventure beckoning to Abram is another characterization of the spirit of truth. This implies nothing less as well, and nothing less magnificent, and once again optimistic in the highest possible sense, than that the truth is the ultimate adventure. Let us first consider the nature of the lie, which is the opposite of the truth, in our attempts to understand this identity. The liar lies either to gain something he does not deserve, would that these stones turn to bread, see Matthew 4, 1-4, or to evade some responsibility or consequence that belongs rightfully to him. Would that the dire fate I brought about myself be lifted from me, see Matthew 4, 5-7. In doing so, he forgoes the changes that would have come to him had he told the truth. Consciousness of the insufficiency that is underlying his desire for gain, exposure to the opportunities that might have opened themselves to him had he shouldered his obligation while making the necessary changes in his life and personality to bear that weight. He substitutes for all that the false adventure of the lie. False, because whatever happens in consequence of a lie is neither real by definition nor genuinely his, as it is not a manifestation of his true character, but of the lie. Thus, the man who lives by the lie lives not his own life, but the life of the lie and the life of the liar, and even the life of the spirit of the lie, which is a Luciferian and a dreadful life indeed. For it is true adventure, not the falseness of the lie, that constitutes the truly and necessarily sustaining meaning in life. In establishing a covenant with the one true God, Abraham swears, in essence, to live by the truth. He is by no means perfectly capable of doing so at the beginning. He is at best an ordinary man. This is very good news for the rest of us, striving to aim up and put our lives together, insofar as we are also ordinary men. In spite of this ordinariness, Abram decides to take a risk. He swears to alter his aim and to accept, even welcome, whatever comes his way along the pathway of the truth. It must be understood. That is the acceptance of adventure itself. Why? Because living in truth, acting truthfully, seeing truthfully, speaking truthfully, means accepting whatever happens in consequence instead of aiming at the target of delusion motivated by the spirit of the lie. That ultimately unpredictable happening, what in the world will come next, attendant upon the truth, is exactly the adventure of life. It is in light of this connection between truth and adventure that Christ says, "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth." So is everyone that is born of the Spirit, John 3:8. Letting everything go of the narrowly self-centered conniving and manipulating means a radical opening up to the possibilities of life, but only those that emerge from the operation of what is true. "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," John 8:32. To accept the call, Abraham must give up his own narrow, self-centered desires, must cease all his machinations, whether for security or unearned gain and privilege, and let the wind take him where it will. Like most of us, Abram is an unlikely prophet, an unlikely candidate for this truthful, adventurous sojourn. He is privileged in the modern parlance. We learn at the very onset of his story that he has lived in unearned comfort under the wing of his parents for more than 7 decades. Abram has a rather serious case of failure to launch. There is more than an intimation in the story that this state of security is insufficient, even infantile. It is certainly unacceptable to God. Otherwise, his call to Abram would have never been issued. Apparently, the proper relationship with God is not easily established while we are comfortably ensconced in the lap of luxury. How then might the good life be more truly constituted? Dostoevsky had some very wise things to say in this regard. Now I ask you, what can be expected of man since he is a being endowed with strange qualities? Shower upon him every earthly blessing, drown him in a sea of happiness, so that nothing but bubbles of bliss can be seen on the surface. Give him economic prosperity such that he should have nothing else to do but sleep, eat cakes, and busy himself with the continuation of his species, and even then, out of sheer ingratitude, sheer spite, man would play you some nasty trick. He would even risk his cakes and would deliberately desire the most fatal rubbish, the most uneconomical absurdity, simply to introduce into all this positive good sense his fatal, fantastic element. We believe, and are constantly promised, seduced to believe, particularly on the political front, that the true paradise would be upon us if only our needs were reliably met, if our wishes were easily gratified. In all seriousness, however, when all of its desires are satisfied, does an infant not merely sleep? What then is consciousness for? Even what does it most truly want, over and above or even instead of mere physical gratification? Maybe it longs, however paradoxically, for trouble, hence the first sin in the Garden of Eden. Or maybe, more positively, it wishes to put everything behind the wheel and to push forward as strenuously as possible. Maybe it wishes to be put in a place of maximal responsibility and voluntarily accepted sacrifice and toil, even of the most extreme sort. Is that not what is portrayed in every drama of romantic adventure? Every movie of secret agent or superhero, when everything is put on the line for the highest possible return by the man who every man wishes he could be? Are we infants? depending on others to quell our distress and provide us the necessities of life while we lie as passive recipients? Or are we the men and women who can and should take on the world and wrestle it into heavenly order? Christ says, "Whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" Mark 8, 34 to 37. To deny himself, that means to forego the blandishments of immediate self-serving instead.